Welcome to the Jeff Knows Inc. Entrepreneurial Podcast with your host, Jeff Lopes. Jeff has over two decades experience as a serial entrepreneur, building brands like Kimuraware from his home basement to a multi-million dollar global brand that has sold over a quarter million pairs of boxing gloves. Jeff's here to educate, guide, and drive you on the process of bringing your ideas and dreams to reality with the inspiring stories from some of the top business minds.
Welcome to episode 117 of the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Lopes. Super excited to have on today Marsha Van Weinsberg. Incredible conversation we had today. Marsha is an incredible mom with an incredible story. Sit back, everyone, and enjoy. We are live on the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I am your host, Jeff Lopes. Super excited to have here today Marsha Van Weinsberg. I broke it down not to make a mistake because we had this conversation before we went on air, and I just wanted to, I'm very anal with getting our guest names correctly pronounced. So Van Weinsberg, can I sit a little quicker now? So I get applause for that. I'm going to use my sound bar.
What a well-timed part for the soundbar. I love it.
How are you today?
I am great. And you?
I'm doing amazing. It's early Tuesday morning in Toronto, Canada. We're actually, Marsha is probably one of the first guests I've had that's somewhat local. So it's going to be an exciting conversation today. We've connected about a month and a half ago. We've had a few incredible conversations so far. So I'm excited to allow this one to progress. Like, I always start off by allowing our audience to know what you're currently doing and what you're up to now, but we're going to change it up. I want to get to know Marsha, where you grew up. Let our audience know where you grew up, how many brothers and sisters you had. Like, give me an understanding of just your childhood in Ontario.
Awesome. I actually was born in Chatham and we lived there for 10 years. And I grew up in, you know, it's a city, but a city area where we would go to the Y, we would do all these things. And then when I was 10, we moved out to a farm. And I know I was miserable with my parents for 2 years. They hated me then. I hate it. I'm like, what is that? Oh, look at the cats. And they're like, no, those are barn cats. You can't go play with them. Like, where are we living? It just was this bizarre.
How old were you?
I was 10.
Yeah.
And we moved to this little farm area. And my dad started another business. And I know times were tough then. It was 1980. And so we lived in this farm area, and I didn't love it, but I grew up in this small town, very, very small town, like no, not even a stoplight. And then I went to school in Tilsonburg and we lived in that area for, oh God, until I went to university. And then I went to university and actually went to University of Waterloo for kinesiology, first in my family to go, and loved all the science of the human body. I just absolutely love that. And did that really for like 27 years, worked with clients in post rehab. And it wasn't until I really understood that it's not just physically what our body goes through, but I mean, I was coaching people to walk again, and I was coaching people to, so there was so much to that, that I'm like, I've literally been coaching for 27 years. So one backup, two parents, I've got my sister who's 2 years younger than me, and my entire family and my husband's entire family live in Tilsonburg still. We are the outcasts that do not.
I love it. I didn't even know that about you with your kin. So you were in the fitness industry. Were you working for a big box gym or a small, like, independent? Were you self-employed? Like, what were you doing with the,
you know what? All of the above. I did all of the above when I first, I gotta go back like 24 years. Oh, I first started working for a physio. I had a really great physio that I worked with, and she was all about, you know, how to get the bodies moving again. Not all physios are like that. They're not. Some are very much about your ice packs and all those things.
Yeah.
I can say that because I've been in the industry and I've seen it. And so I learned that from her. And then from there, I worked in, I realized there was this gap that people would finish physio, but they were technically discharged, but they weren't ready for what life was yet. And I went, I think I could actually work with people in that gap. And so when I started in Tillsonburg at that point, I was literally like one of the first personal trainers. It wasn't something anybody talked about, but I did it as a kin. So then we moved to Waterloo. I actually worked in at Good Life for about a year. And then I owned my own brick and mortar with four partners. So I got to see that aspect of it. Left a brick and mortar in 2009 and then went from there to work as a contractor, basically independent contractor for the next 10 years. So I've seen all sides of it. So, you know, I think that I think it's really important to see all sides of it. As I look at it now, I mean, especially with where we are economy wise and what's happening in Ontario, like I can relate to my friends who own a brick and mortar. I understand it's like, it's hard without the pandemic to have a brick and mortar store. And so I've seen all sides of business and I'm grateful for all the lessons, no matter how messy they were.
I love that. There's so much to unpack there. One, I guess we come from the same world. And I think talk about that slightly when I was in your podcast, because my first real business at 19, I started when 17, but 19 was consulting fitness. And I had six personal trainers working for me at that time. So this is going to back to 95, 96. Yeah. And I had six trainers working to me, all doing in-house training. And I did consulting for gyms and I was contracted by a big box. I don't even want to get their name in here, but big box location. And I was instilling personal training systems in the back end. I was doing back end systems. So this crazy little small world. And then I had also a brick and mortar gym. I've had a few of them and I built them and got rid of them as well. But what you said there with the brick and mortar, that's something I've always had that mindset, maybe as an entrepreneur naturally coming in and looking at just business in general. I always had that mindset with the brick and mortar where it was always something to build and get rid of, because I wouldn't want it that mindset of you're praying that somebody's coming in your door. You're praying that somebody's walking your door, right? And I think people that don't understand it fully, they think they're going to open up this door and everybody's going to rush to them. And they don't understand the mindset of, I remember I did studies on this and that mindset of the marketing, how people's mind works with marketing is they say an average person has to drive by a location 7 to 10 times before they even recognize it's there. And then they might have to stop drive by another 5 to 10 times before they actually get the inclination that, you know what, I'm going to stop and pull in. And that's if they need something from there. So the odds of something stopping to go in your location is so, so rare. And that's with a good drive-through traffic. So if you're not in a great high traffic location and you're just hoping for the business to come in, man, it is a hard having a brick and mortar, whether it's a mama papa restaurant, whether it's a gym, whether it's anything, especially if you're dealing with a mama papa smaller location and in a smaller town, it's not easy. It is not easy surviving. It's not like back in the day when everybody had the father and the mama papa butcher shops and stuff like that. All the locals like support it. There's not that support anymore. It's very rare to see that support because everybody deals with the big boxes. Let's talk about yourself now. So what age did you get married at?
23. I married my high school sweetheart. Just for anybody who knows, we're about to, like, we'll be 28 years married this year and amazing. Together for 35.
Amazing,
I know.
Amazing, 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 amazing. When did you have your first little one?
I had him at 27. And then I had my second one at 28. So they were back to back and I had a lot of health issues leading up to that and after that. And it wasn't until years later realized that I had like very severe endometriosis. So I was I really look at it, like I was blessed to have the two that I had because we had, I think, 5 miscarriages total.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What did motherhood mean to you?
Hmm.
And I want to ask you what it means to you now. I want to see the difference in your mindset.
That's so interesting. You know what? I remember, and I can say this, and my kids would say this too. I remember like it was very important to me, but I always had this feeling like I was raising them to be able to take care of themselves. I remember thinking that from a young age, like even if we actually just joked about this recently. But even from the standpoint of let them learn to feed themselves, let them make a mess, let them do, like, let them learn. It's because I used to say to my husband, they're not mine to keep. They're not mine to keep. They're not mine. They're mine to raise, to be independent. And so it was always important to me that they were independent and they learned how to make decisions from a young age. Like, I remember it's so funny, but I remember, you know, one day my oldest wanted to take something to school. And I said, well, if you take it to school and it, you lose it or it breaks, whose choice was it to take to school? And he was like, mine. I'm like, so if it breaks or you lose it, then that's your choice that you took it. And he's like, I know that. And then came home and he's like, I lost it. And I'm like, well, it's like, who took it to school? Like, it's interesting because as motherhood went and challenges came in, I look back and I literally still had the same attitude all the way through, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I love that you said that because we live in a society now that it's there's a word I'm trying to think of now. Is it not privilege, or I don't even say privilege, but we live in a society that everybody feels, the younger generation feels that everything is due to them. There's a word I'm trying to think of right now.
Well, you know, they call parents for a long time, they called them helicopter parents. You know what they're using now as the term is lawnmower parents, because lawnmower parents go ahead of their kids and mow everything out of their way to make the road smooth.
I love that. I love that.
And I was like,
I 1000% agree with that. I 1000% agree with that.
Make it easier for them. So there is no obstacles that they have to go through.
And they're not prepared for life. And well, as crazy as I'm going to jump in there quickly, because I don't know if you ever see my posts and stuff, like,
oh, yeah.
My kids, they both, my kids now 13, 14, they both do laundry. They both cook. They both make their beds. They're both independent. They both know how, like, I make sure they know how to save. I'm teaching them how to save money. I'm teaching them life skills because exactly, we're not going to be there forever. We're just holding their hand now and guiding them and allowing them to be prepared and teaching them to be prepared. And I think a lot of parents don't do that. And when kids get to the real world, they're not ready for nothing. Like I have my kids are the other day, I took them driving. I've been every weekend now teaching my 13, 14 year old how to drive. And I'm like, I'm preparing them. I'm always the one where my wife thinks I'm crazy sometimes. I'm always the one we're putting them in scenarios like, okay, if you're home and this happens, like the house gets on fire, I'm always preparing them. If somebody comes knocking on the door, you're not, or if you're like, I always prepare them when you're walking home. If somebody says something to you, this is the way you run. This is the house, mm-hmm. You know? So I'm always putting the worst case scenario and preparing them because I think it's that mindset. If you could think of the situation and manifest in your head and be prepared for it, if it ever does happen, you're not going to overreact. You'll be able to calmly deal with it. And I think a lot of people don't know how to react to situations.
Oh, I think that's great. Exactly what you said. And I think that's our role, to be honest. I actually think of course it's to love them and those are unwritten, but it's how they are prepared is entirely on us. Like my oldest son's girlfriend said to me the other day, she goes like, he cooks, he does this. I'm like, you're welcome. You're welcome, because he did that when he was younger. I remember them being 12, 11 to even 10 to 12. And they had to plan one meal a week. Yeah. And I didn't care if we had soup and grilled cheese. I didn't care, but they always knew. They still joke to this day. We had to have salad. No matter what we did, we had to have salad. Yeah, Mom said greens, we had to have salad. Yeah. Yeah, greens. But it's letting them have that responsibility because it's a good thing for them to do.
Oh, 100%. And they enjoy it. Like we put in a situation where they enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And I even have them at this age where once a month, like they save, like every time they go to grandma or the in-laws or any of the grandparents' houses, they always give them money and give them stuff. So I make sure they save in their piggy banks. And I always tell them, like, even like once a month, if we go out for ice cream, I'm like, okay, who's treating today? And I make them one of them treat once a month. Yeah. They treat, whether it's $10, $15, I'll end up putting the money back in there, but it's just for them to learn how to take their own money and pay and stuff like that. So I think those life skills are so, so important. You have an incredible story, and I'm sure you've told it a million times. But we're going to just go through it, and I just want to let the audience know about your story, and I think it'd be very impactful just for other parents going through similar situations. Because I think 2020 was an eye opener for mental health for children being put in a situation where they were uncomfortable, right? Being homeschooled, not being able to socialize, not being able to go outside, not able to see their friends. And I think a lot of our youth are suffering, and maybe a lot of parents aren't aware of it. So let's talk about your son and just give me a little rundown of the timeline and how it all came together, and let our audience know the story.
Okay, great. I have two sons. We went through, and I mean, everything I say, I didn't see it coming. I didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
And I also reflect before I dive into it. My husband and I constantly look at this last year and think, what would we do if this is what we were living during this time? I don't know what we would have done. We started dealing, I think it was probably just under about 10 years ago. And we started to experience drugs in our house. And I was like, what? Like, what do you mean? What? Like, my kids are in grade 7 and grade 8. I don't understand. So the first time we were finding pot. And at that time, you know, so many people going, oh, well, kids go through this phase and et cetera, et cetera. But every time we saw it, we would get rid of it and we would like, absolutely not. But there's just no other way to say it other than it never went away. It was never a phase. It never came and left. It just came and escalated. That's the only way to describe it. No matter how many times we fought trying to stop it, it just escalated. And so it was never a case of it being like just pot, because it eventually went to a number of things. And it's always interesting because it brings up so many stories. People go, well, it's not a gateway drug. It's not this. It's not that. You know what? When young kids are exposed to something like that, especially boys, because their brains do develop later. They do. And when that happens for some kids, it becomes something that they have to have. It is addictive. Yeah. And it drives me bonkers when people say it's not. And I'm like, well, we lived through it. And I can tell you it was 100% that it was. And as it escalated, we fought it for those first couple of years were nonstop. It got ugly. They were minors. So they were 100% our responsibility, as they always were. But as a parent in Ontario, compared to other places that I was speaking with at the time, it's if your kids are under 16 in Ontario, you have zero rights of any kind. But you have all of the responsibilities. And that is a no-win situation. On the flip coin of that, you have kids who literally can do what they want. We had no backing from police, from schools, from like everywhere we went. It was like, well, it's a phase and you need to do something with it. I'm like, I don't know what else to do. Like, we just literally, it just wouldn't stop. And so by the time our kids, like before they were 16, both of them were gone from the house. By that point, we're like, it had impacted and affected, I didn't say infected, every area of our lives, home, personal, jobs. My husband had lost his job at that point because it was chaos is an understatement. What we were living through, kids missing for days on end, missing, not coming home, damaging house, scary. They had changed personalities. They were not my kids anymore. And many people would say, I've had many people say unbelievable things to me, but many people say that, well, at least you didn't lose them. Like, at least they didn't die and you didn't lose them. I'm like, oh, I lost them. Like, you have to understand, there were months on end that I didn't know where they were and never spoke to them. And it was a case of, I did lose who they were. Like, I got to a space through a lot of support and counseling that if they ever came back, they weren't the same person anymore.
What age were they at this point?
I would say by the time we hit 15 and 16, it was an absolute
early high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the time we were in grade 9, 10, didn't even make it to 11.
Were you aware of their friends and who they hung around with and all this?
By this point, No, there was nothing. Like they were.
You live in a small town. Like don't it doesn't. I mean, this might be like small town folk. But doesn't everybody kind of know each other? Like parents.
Well, we're in Kitchener Waterloo.
Oh, you're like, in Kitchener now.
Yeah, and we were then, and we were in Kitchener. We moved here in 2001.
Yeah.
But we lived in a subdivision that I'm going to say stereotypically, you're like, well, this doesn't happen here. Like, that's the kind of thinking that I'm being very transparent that I was like, I don't understand. Like, what is, this doesn't happen here. This is not what, but in fact it does. And it actually happens significantly more in some of those areas. So by the time we were like, just to frame it even more, we had other parents who didn't think it was a big deal to let the kids smoke pot in the house at 13 because it's, and people who you would look at it and go, what? But they didn't. So to me, I think our life was a perfect storm. It was a perfect storm of age where the schools were just passing them no matter what, where they were, the police were like, there's nothing we can do. They're minors. And, nobody cared what they were doing or had a problem with it except for mom and dad. Even other parents were like, oh, it's a phase. It'll happen. It comes. I'm like, I'm just not a phase. Like my kid is like sneaking out of the house at 13. I can't find him. Like, this is not a phase. And that was, it was just a case of a perfect, perfect storm. So there were many other contributing factors, but there were a number of parents who didn't have an issue with it at all. And I did, obviously, and it's just in, and I fought it. And even when we look back now, many times I used to say to them, was there any point that you were confused about my opinions about drugs in our house of any kind? And they're like, oh no, you were always very clear. I'm like, so there was no point that I was not like, I was like being wishy-washy. And they're like, oh no, mom, you were like super clear. I'm like, okay. So I did everything. And that's the point is that you have to come to a space as a parent. Probably one of the hardest moments was when I realized that I couldn't control this anymore. Like I've tried everything I had to control this.
And that is going through like outside help, outside resources.
So much.
Yeah.
Like I remember I remember taking my little sheet of paper, and this sounds so silly now, but I would go from counselor to support to programs to, and say, okay, like I've checked off everything you've told me, but I still have the problem. So I don't even understand, what am I supposed to do? Because you told me to check these boxes and I've checked them. So what do I do now? And they're like, nothing. It's not your problem to solve. And I'm like, really? My 16-year-old is going to die. Like, I don't understand. There's nothing I can do. And they're like, if they don't consent to going to a doctor, to going to a counselor.
How does that even like make sense? They're a minor. You still have full custody and rights over them, but you don't have control to put them into a...
No.
That is crazy.
People don't realize that until you go through that scenario.
No, I would never in a million years even think that. I would think you, as a parent, you would have full custody rights to say, hey, you know what? You're going to rehab. It is what it is.
No. And you can't take them to rehab unless they consent.
Yeah.
You can't take them. You can't make them get a doctor's appointment if they don't consent after 12. I'm dead serious. I'm dead serious. People do not understand this. So when we were at a point, and I remember I had an officer, see, I had to get to a space of finding my own voice where I would push back when an officer would say to me, why aren't you getting him help? I'm like, tell me what help to get. Cause I'm doing it. Like I'm doing this, but tell me what else I'm supposed to do. Yeah. Well, you need to get them to a counselor. I'm like, I can't take them if they don't consent. So how am I supposed to consent them? Because honestly, let me just paint the picture right now. Teenagers can be a handful anyways.
Of course.
Now I've got two teenagers I don't know if I can swear on the show, but their shit doesn't stink. They can't do anything wrong and they know it. So can you imagine how much that amplifies the whole situation? Because it was a joke to them. They were like, we can do whatever we want because school's going to pass us. Police can't do anything.
If the cops caught them with drugs, I mean, they could have charged them
multiple times. They were caught with drugs, multiple.
And they were never charged.
Nope. So one time, and I actually worked my way up to meet the chief of police because I was a pain in the ass. And like I did not go away. I was a squeaky wheel. And I remember one time my oldest son was caught and like with a whole backpack of pot. And he was young, and the police, three police officers show up at the door, and I kid you not, they laughed and said, he's a runner. And I'm like, what's a runner? I don't even know what a runner is. And they're like, well, he's a runner. He runs drugs for older because they are untouchable. And I'm like, wait, you caught him with it and you know he does that? So what are we going to do? And no joke, they laughed and they're like, well, we know we'll be back here lots of times. That was the end of it. So
Wow. It's
a perfect storm of a scenario where, you know,
it's a broken system.
It's a very broken system, and people don't realize that. So we had to get to a point where it was that I had to come to a space of forcing some things to happen, like forcing things to happen. And as a parent, and I don't know if it's changed since then, I doubt it, but is that you have to push to have charges placed. So that's the space I had to go to as a parent. They will not charge a minor without the parent's consent and agreement. So now as a parent, you're trying everything you can to save your kids and do what you can, and you have to be the one to charge them. And knowing what I know now, I wish I'd have done it so much sooner. So we've charged both of our kids multiple times. We spent multiple occasions in court, so many I could never count them. And that's the space we had to come to, because I had to go to a headspace of realizing my job as a parent is to give their future self a chance.
Yeah. Yeah.
My job is not for you to like me. We're way past that. Like, we're way past you even considering to like me. It's not my job. My job is to give your future self a chance. I remember sitting in court once and being very open with, and my son looking down and going, what, did you do this? Like, did you actually charge me? And I'm like, 100%. And I'll do it every single time I have to, because that's my job as a parent. I'm giving you a chance. I want to give you a chance to survive. And that's a really tough space to come to. And then combine that with our story, literally scaring the crap out of everyone, that so many parents, when we respond out of fear, we say things that are just dumb. Like, we say dumb things. They were very critical. They were very like, do something with your kids. I'm like, what else do you want me to do? Like, people would come to our door and saying, how could you do this to your kids? Why don't you do something? But I had to come to a space of understanding that our story scared the crap out of people. It scared them, because if it could happen to us, it could happen to anyone else.
Yeah.
And nobody wants that. Or people would say, what did you do wrong? What did you do wrong? Tell me what you did wrong so that we don't do that. I'm like, yeah, I didn't buy it for them. I never gave them money for it. I fought it every step of the way. It's not mine to own. And literally, ownership and choices had to become part of my mantra words that I used every day. I had to use them every day to mentally come to a space. Okay, this isn't my choice. I can't own their choice. This is my choice. I have to take this choice. And I would get to this space of, you know, you have, like, we all go through stages where we're angry. I was so angry. I was so angry at them, at the world. I felt like we were just on an island by ourselves fighting to survive. And I was so angry. And I had to come to a space of letting go of that anger and just go, well, you are where you are now because of all of the choices that you've made. You don't need to blame me. I'm not blaming you for it. But if you want something different, you have to make a different choice. I can't make that for you. This is your choice. And it got to the point where they'd be like, I know it's my choice. I'm like, okay, cool. So make a different one. Make a different one. Just make a different one. Like, just change and make a different one. And it's funny, as a parent, those were my models right from the very beginning. But when chaos started, I wanted to do anything I could to fix them, change them, help them to survive. Yeah. And then I also had to realize that's not my job. My job is to lead myself so that maybe they can, like, they can see that. And a counselor said to me at one point, she said, you have to understand that you have to be a springboard for them. If they ever decide that they come back and want your support, and right now you're a big pile of quicksand, you can't do anything for them if you wanted to. And I went, holy crap, she's true. Like, that's right. And that was a real turning point for me to realize I had to take care of myself first, because at the end of the day, the only way all of us make a change is when we own our own choices. It's literally the only way. You have to take ownership for where you're at in order to make a change. So I had to do that. And then eventually they decided to do that. And I had to let go of all of it. Like, I just had to, and it sounds flippant, but I want people to know, like, it was a process of years for me to learn to just say, I can't own that. You don't want to go to school anymore. Okay, cool. You can't live here. If you want to live here, you have to go to school. It's just simple. It's really simple. Well, I don't know where I'm going to live. I'm like, I don't know either, but you're going to go to school and live here, or you're not. And my oldest son, I watched him. They both did their own things, but he, you know, he worked washing dishes for probably a year and a half, and he was collecting social assistance. And I remember the day he came in, he goes, Mom, I don't think I want to do this anymore. And I'm like, yeah, I get that. And he's like, I think I want to go back to school. I'm like, it's a good idea. He's like, will you come into the school and talk with me to help them to make it work? And I'm like, I think you can do this. Like, I'll go with you to the school, but you totally got this. And then he was like, Mom, I think I want to, like, double up and finish school faster. Do you think I can do that? I'm like, I think you can do that. And he did. He did a year and a half in, like, two terms while living on his own, while washing dishes, while doing those things. And I remember at one point he said,
you know, this is your oldest or youngest?
This is my oldest. They've both done different things incredibly well. And my oldest came and he said something about, I don't know how it went, but it was something, the fact that, you know, a lot of people said that they stepped in and that's why I made the changes that I did. And I said, you know what? I want you to know something. You are the one that made this happen. Like, you are the one that made the change, that decided to do this. You get to own it all yourself, because I'm not going to take credit for that, because you did that. Like, we have to let them own their wins and their failures and choices too. I think that there's pros. I think we have to do both. And it's like, I've been here and so I will always love you. Always love you. I won't tolerate certain choices, but I'll still always love you. And I think that's the space I had to come to. I know it's a lot.
No, it's a lot to unpack, right? And I knew a part of your story. I didn't know it to the full extent. And it's hard, because through a lot of those moments, even when, I think this is something we talked about, if I'm not mistaken, but through a lot of those moments, you had to be courageous. I'm sure for everybody else around you, other family members, everybody else, you had to put this front and be this strong presence, even though inside you were falling apart.
Yes.
And I think that is, some people think it's not courage, but that is a huge part of being courageous. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we talked about this, but when we came home in the hospital with my son, my wife went through a stage where she was blaming herself for that. She had put in her mind that she couldn't understand why she didn't drink, she didn't smoke, she took care of herself, and this happened, and crackhead moms were having healthy babies. And she couldn't understand that. She blamed herself. And then I had my parents and my in-laws and everybody stressed in this high anxiety. And I kind of had to calm the situation down, even though I mentally was going through a lot myself, but I just kind of put a shield on it and said, you know what? I gotta deal with everybody else. I'll deal with myself later. And I kept putting it down. And I think that is, in a way, now that I could go look back at it, it is being very courageous, which you did. But sometimes at that moment, you don't even realize what you're doing, right? You just do it out of, like, necessity. I got to do what I got to do.
Yes. And that is it to a T. I have been called the strong one my whole life, the whole life. And I think that sometimes, I don't deny it, but being strong and being called that also means this subconscious thought that I have to do it by myself. And I just have to keep pushing. And I always say that there comes a point in life where our strengths actually become our weakness if we're not aware of them. I was super, super strong. I pushed like crap. I just never stopped. But pushing wasn't fixing my scenario. The only thing that fixed it is recognizing that that's not mine to own. And I had to let that go. And I remember the day that like we were in a space of almost losing both of our boys 4 days apart. And they were both in our home. And I went, okay, so I'm killing myself trying to keep them safe in my house. And it's not working because it's not mine to do. It's not mine to do anymore. And that was a point of letting go and just, it's going to have, whatever's going to unfold, it's going to unfold. And we're super fortunate now in that we have like, we've had to rebuild relationships. I'm not lying, but to us to be able to have, you know, our kids over for dinner and have like a great conversation and very open conversations with them and to hear them talk about, you know, my one son said to me, Mom, do you remember all those people who yelled at you for throwing us out at 16? I'm like, oh yeah, vividly. Yeah. I remember. And he remember all that. He's like, yeah, they're still fighting with their kids. Like they're still fighting with their kids and they're like 23 and 24. So, you know, it's easy to throw stones. It's easy to give opinions and it's easy to be critical of people. And when you're the strong one, all that did was make me put more and more armor up. And I use Brené Brown's quote. I love her work, obviously. But she talks about the armor and we carry this armor to protect us from the world. But the problem is that, cause we think it's going to block out pain. It doesn't. What happens is the armor gets super, super heavy. And it blocks out all emotions because we can't selectively choose which emotions we block out. Mm-hmm. And then our world gets really, really small. And then now it's, then all of a sudden you have the realization that my world is small. I still have pain. I still have the story. This isn't working. Like this is not working. That is when I started to embrace vulnerability and realize that, wait a minute, what if a counselor said, what if you're actually meant to do something with your story? And I'm like, what do you mean do something? And she said, I have this gut feeling you're meant to do something with it in a positive way. The second I could think about, wait, you mean I could turn something good out of this? That was the turning point for me. Now, again, I would love to say I had support from everybody, and that's not true because I was very much so, like I felt very alone. We had family trying to do and give their opinions and help. So it required me really being selective about my inner circle and who I surrounded myself with and being vulnerable and showing up and opening up and allowing new people to come in. So every time somebody would leave, or somebody would say something hurtful, or they would like ridicule me publicly in the grocery store. No joke. I would be like, okay, that's another person who's gone. I can't wait to see who's going to come in. That's the mind space I had to live in because I had to change my thinking completely. I had to, I was never going to survive. It was actually about survival. It wasn't about thriving. I had to survive. And that's some of those are the steps that I had to take to do that.
Yeah. But it's so impactful. I mean, when you are at that mindset as a human to be able to recognize, and I think it's such a powerful thing, recognize that the negativity in your life, those people that are negative, that you're okay with letting them go. You're okay with realizing that they had a purpose in your life and that purpose is gone and I can move on from them. I think it's such a powerful thing. Because exactly you said it, that armor, it just takes a lot of weight off. And it's just the simplest way of looking at it. And it's something I say all the time. And I think a lot of you hear this a lot is stop giving a shit what people think of you. And the minute you could own that and stop giving a shit what people think of you is that freedom of just like, hey, I'm doing this for me. I love myself. I'm doing this for me. And everybody around me that I care of, they all understand I have their best interests, but I'm doing this for me. And the minute you can take care of yourself, and then you're able to serve everybody else. And I think that's the biggest issue is I think of a lot of parents that go through scenarios like yourself, they're all about protecting their kids, but they're not protecting themselves.
Right.
And the minute you could protect yourself and own yourself and do it for yourself and understand yourself and understand what you're going through, it just gives everything so much more light and understanding. So I appreciate that. Let's go quickly. There's the other part of your story I want to get into with your coaching and everything you've kind of moved into, but let's just finish off with your kids. Like, what are they up to now? And just give a brighter light, because they're obviously in a more clear set place right now. And they're achieving a lot more right now. And obviously, things are looking a lot brighter now. So give the audience a little understanding of where they are right now and how old they are right now.
They are going to be 24 and 23. And my one son is in college for certified financial planner and finishing his Canadian securities designation. He is brilliant. They're both brilliant in their way. And he just didn't fit the mold of school because he just thinks differently. And so he literally sits in his day doing school and then his screens, and he literally invests and does his own investments. He's going to be worth more before he's 30. Then it's amazing. So that's him. And my other son created a clothing design business and he sews clothing. Okay. He was my jock. I'm going to say he was like a kid who did every sport, excelled. And, you know, he was always fascinated by clothes and would design t-shirts and stuff when he was younger, and he loved it. So then he got a sewing machine and learned how to sew. None of us have those skills. My sister does, but no idea where it comes from. But he designs very unique things and has created his website and is doing all of these amazing things with it and is building a business. So it's interesting because, you know, you have those moments as the parent where they'll reach back and say, "Mom, you know, can I get a book off your bookshelf? Because I think I want to work on some of my thinking." I'm like, "Sure, pick whichever one you want." Whereas instead of saying like, "Read this, do this," it's like, be that person so that they can see it and what's possible. And I remember somebody saying to me once, "Okay, so great. They got high school. What are you going to do with that?" And I'm like, "What do you mean?" And they're like, "Well, if they're not doing college or university, it's not going to be anything." I'm like, "Right now, my kids are alive and I'm grateful as hell. Like, that is literally where my headspace is. I just wanted them to do whatever makes them happy." So with my son who is sewing and creating like really unique designs, he made a comment once, you know, like, you know, "Are you okay with this?" I'm like, "You're thrilled. I'm happy. We're good." Like, honestly, that's my level of expectation. I'm just so happy that they are here and healthy, and we get to have, you know, Sunday dinner with them. So it's when you have a lot of challenges in your life, you learn how to be grateful for what you have in that present moment. And yeah, last year when the pandemic started, a lot of people were like, you know, "Oh my gosh, your birthday, it's your 50th birthday. And this is the worst thing in the world." I'm like, "This isn't bad. Like, this isn't bad." It's not you. It's you learn to think differently. And my husband and I would laugh because I'm like, "Oh, I think our years prepped us for this. This is nothing. Like, this is nothing." And so it's interesting, as hard as those years were, I could have never learned the lessons that I needed to learn from a book. I completely changed as a person. And yes, it was hard. Yes, it was ugly. I'm so grateful for it. I know that sounds bizarre. I am so very grateful for it.
I love that. I mean, that's something I talk about all the time too. I go, everything that happened to my son and happened to us as a family, I wouldn't change it. That's what has made me as a man and made us as a family.
Yeah.
So I agree with that 1,000%. You have to embrace and understand impactful stories and understand, embrace those stories and let them be open and honest with them. Right. So I love that part of it.
Yeah.
You have transitioned into the coaching world, and obviously you took the advice to tell your story. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about that and what you're currently doing in your space right now.
It's so interesting when I look back at it. When I started deciding to share my story, I started speaking on small stages. I was actually came to the space of connecting with the school, and my husband and I would go speak with other parents. Like, that's how open we became with it. And we just went, okay, I think this actually, every time we would do it, it'd be like, I think this story is meant to help people. And when I learned how to speak, I had to go through the process of learning how to share my story from my perspective. That means really not sharing a lot about my kids. A lot of people assume that I am very vulnerable about myself. I don't share a lot of details about my kids because that's their story. Yeah. And it's my story to share my story. And so I started sharing on stages, and a mentor said to me, I think you have a book. And I'm like, I have a book. There's no way I have a book. And she's like, and I love her to this day. And I still always thank her for it. She's like, you absolutely have a book. You have to start writing. But I've been journaling for years. And then I started to look at it and I went, well, what would I share in a book? And it became so clear that I wanted to be able to share my story to help others make it through a challenge in their life. Like, what do you do when life doesn't go as planned, which is always, just so you know. And it's like, what do you do? And how do you find your way again? So I shared my journey of how do I make it through and how did I make it through and change and get to where I was. And the name of the book was called When She Stopped Asking Why, because that's when my life changed, was when I stopped asking why, when I stopped being a victim of my story and started to see it differently. So I didn't start with a business in mind, not even on the radar. I started with a book and then I started with a podcast long before podcasting was a thing. Yeah. I didn't know what I was doing. It was messy. It was action, but I just wanted to create a space to share stories. And the reason I wanted to do that is because nobody was talking at that time. Nobody was talking about difficult stories. And I thought, well, maybe you're supposed to go first. Maybe you have to go first. And so I started with a podcast and I started with a book. And over time, people would say, could you help me with this? Could you help me with this? And I'm like, oh, I like doing this. I liked helping others. And it wasn't until probably 2019 that people were saying, but how do you share a story? I don't understand how to share a difficult story. How do you do that? And I went, oh, I get it. They're all asking the same things. And that's when I started to work my way into coaching. And I was doing part-time coaching in 2019, really enjoying it, but still working my full-time job. And I just had this gut feeling that I was supposed to be doing something more. So I literally journaled the whole year in 2019 that this was the last year I was in my job. Didn't know how I was going to do it. Then my husband lost his job during that year. And it was like, okay, well, that's going to have to go on the back burner. You got to keep working. And I did. And then literally he found a job and then COVID started and I lost my job. So I was like, okay, I remember March 17th, my college of kinesiologists saying you cannot work. And I came home and I'm like, what am I going to do? Like, I don't have a job. What am I going to do? And I remember sitting there going, okay, but you asked for space. You asked for, again, that's ownership. I remember thinking, I don't want to regret this. I want to make the most of it. So March 18th, I woke up and I went hard. Like I literally dove in and just committed to learning. How am I going to do this? What's this going to look like? Yeah. And I've seen the transition over the year. Now I also went through, you know, it was just a lot growing last year with COVID and everything that happened. And I did that and then ended up going through back surgery last year too. So I was one of the people who actually did get surgery last year during COVID. So to say 2020 was a year of transition and transformation is an understatement. And I've just kind of embraced all of it and jumped into the coaching full time.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. Where do you see yourself in the next 2-3 years? Do you have a mindset of like, this is what I do, how many times I want to be on stage? Like, do you have some type of visualization of where you want to take this?
Yeah, I see it. I really see it becoming I just have this goal of like 100 women that I work with. I say women, and I do have men in my circle too, but women who I help them to learn how to like embrace themselves and share their story authentically. Because I think whether you're a coach or whether you do own a brick and mortar or whether you do own another business, you have to learn how to show up authentically and show who you are, because there's a lot of noise out there and we can't all be each other. We're not supposed to be each other. We're supposed to be ourselves and show up as ourselves. And that means sharing who we are. And that's part of our stories and part of the lessons that we've learned. And that's our strength. Like that's our strength. It's not a weakness. It's our strength. Yeah. So I see that of stepping into that space of helping many women. I really would love, I don't know how, I see it stepping into some kind of almost like a certification program where people learn how to go through those steps of creating and like understanding their story, unpacking it, building themselves, and then taking it into their business, whether it's podcasting, speaking, coaching, or writing. There's a lot of ways to share your businesses. There's hundreds of ways to build a business. but you still have to go first. No matter what it is, you are your business. At all times, you are your business. And yeah, so that's the piece that I speak into. But I do see it being another book, as I was writing this chapter for this collaborative book, and it's completely new material and new information. I handed it in. She did her edits and she's like, oh crap, you have another book in there. I'm like, I do. I can feel it. I can see another collaborative book coming, because there's so much power in learning how to share our stories. And I just think that's how we connect to each other. And without that, everything is just superficial. And I just, honestly, I call it age, call it whatever. I just don't have the time or energy for superficial anymore. I'd rather just get to know people.
Authenticity, right?
Yes. Yes. 100%.
I love that. I mean, part of my Man's Purpose program, when you join, the first thing you do, and we built this like 6-7 months ago, the first thing you do when you join is you have to literally answer about 20 different questions about your story, to own your story, understand your story, and make everybody write it down. So I think it's such a powerful thing when people could embrace and understand their story, because I think a lot of people really never take the time to understand it or truly just sit back and intake it, right? They go on with their lives, and they never really understand their true story and what how to embrace and how to use that to impact others, right?
I love everything that you just said. I think to add to it, when it's our difficult parts of our life, we like to hide that. We don't want people to see it. We're like it's messy. I don't want people to see that part. And I laugh because I'm like, yeah, that mess, that's like where your gifts are. That's where your strengths are. That's where your lessons are. Like, the more you can embrace unpacking that, the more connections you can find. I had a message the other day. I get messages all the time. I had a message the other day from Australia. And she was like, I don't understand what you mean about going first. I don't have that support. I don't have those people in my life. And I'm like, you have to be willing to go first and decide that this is not how you want your life to be. And that might mean walking away from everyone. I literally even walked away from family for months, because I used to say my circle, my inner circle, is an invite only space. This is the only space where I can conserve my energy, because we were still living in the chaos. Yeah, okay. Yeah. You can't walk away from that. So you have to take care of you. Yeah. And so that's it. You have to do you first and really embrace those messy parts, because that's how we all connect with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I mean, when we got home with my son, I literally turned off our answering service. I literally shut off the world, and I knew he was my purpose. Even for those 4 months when he was in hospital, like, we literally shut off everybody. And that was because I needed to conserve my energy for that purpose, to get him out of the hospital. And I realized that very quickly. And it wasn't something where I was thinking about it. It just came natural. It's like, okay, I have a certain amount of energy I can't waste on people crying or people dealing with trying to make everybody else happy. It was a mindset. Honestly, Marshall was like, screw the world. My son's my purpose. I got to get his ass out of the hospital. And that's my focus. And that was all I focused my energy on. And that was, I think, what got me through, because if I was so worrying about answering the phone and telling everybody the story and telling everybody what was happening and updating everybody, I was just like, that would have just destroyed me. And I made it very clear right off the bat. I told everybody, I turned off our answering service at home. I turned off my business line. I told everybody, and I said, this is for the next, till my son gets home, or to whatever happens, no one's going to hear from me. Just let me do my stuff. I'll take care of myself. And that's what we did. And it was hard for my wife, because my wife wanted other support. And I was like, no, we'll do this. We'll get through this. And
that's smart intuition. That is really, really smart intuition.
It wasn't something where in my head I had a plan. It was just something where in my head, I just knew it was just in my head. I was like, that is what I need to focus on right now. Like I can't, there's not enough energy in the day to focus on other things. Yeah. And I realized that. Right. And I'm grateful I did that. Right. It just happened, but I'm grateful I did that. One quick question before we head off today. If something were to happen to you today, in a few words, how would you want to be remembered or described by your loved ones?
I would want to be remembered as a courageous person who gave others the permission to show up. I really want to be remembered as, like, she gave me permission to be me, to show me what was possible. Like, she just gave me permission to not be afraid of how it will unfold or whatever that is. And she also gave me permission to know that I could do something very positive with a difficult story in my life. Like she gave me permission. That would mean the world to me.
Love it. Love it. I love it. How could our audience get a hold of you, follow you, give some information? I'm going to put it all in our show notes either way, but just give a little shout out to what's your best social media handle and your website and all that stuff.
Absolutely. It is Marcia Van W is on Instagram. You start typing Marcia Van W and it'll come up, whether it's website, Facebook. It's like, that was when I realized early in business that I'm going to use my name because that's what all comes up. So it was easy. So that's where you'll find all kinds of things. And I do, you know, small breakthrough sessions. I do, you know, intro sessions to help people with storytelling. And then I do group coaching and 12-week programs and just really help people to unpack what their story is. It depends on what level they are at and wanting to create change. I think the biggest thing is that I recognize, like, I work best with people who are like, okay, help me with how, like, how do I do this? If you're in the early stages in the victim, then, and I spent a long time there, so I don't judge that at all. That's not where my strength is. I'm the one who can help you to see it differently and make those moves. And there's nothing wrong with getting support and counseling because I did it for years, like it's years. So that's kind of the stage that I step in and help people. But usually when people are in a space, they say, I just feel like I'm supposed to do something with my story. And I'm like, yep, yeah, that's where I was for a long time. And learning how to do that and realizing that we all have so much internal power that when we learn how to use it, we can change anything.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. This has been awesome. We've had about 3 or 4 great conversations the last month. So I appreciate you. And excited to continue to see you grow because there's a lot of impact still happening there and a lot of more impact in the future. So I appreciate you and I appreciate everything you're doing. And thank you for being a guest.
Oh, thank you so much. Honestly, I've loved our conversations we've had over the last month and this was great. You had some great questions and really had me dig, which I love. So thank you.
Thank you. That's a wrap for today. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Marcia as much as I have. Please do, like always, spread the word, tell your friends, tell your family, leave a review. 5 stars would be incredible. We always love spending time reading the reviews. Until next week, guys, keep moving forward.